So, waiting for some more people, let's see if there are questions from the first part of this classes, that is Article 1, which deals with Congress. Is everything clear? Two chambers, Senate, House? Any questions on the last lessons?
With Britain, so it's I don't understand why they have it so similar if they think that the British people oppressed them.
They didn't think that British people oppressed them. They thought that the King and Parliament oppressed them, namely the King. If you read the Declaration of Independence, is basically an accusation, a violent pamphlet against King George the Third. But they considered themselves English, and they knew no other political system. We must bear in mind that in 1776 the American Revolution was the first one. Around the world there were only monarchies or other forms of non-democratic government. There were a few examples of ancient republics, but no immediate example to follow. Therefore, they made the best of what they knew, the English system. More questions? So let's turn to Article 2 of the Constitution. Article 2 deals with the executive power, and it starts like this: "The executive power shall be vested in the President of the United States of America. He shall hold his office during the term of 4 years, and together with the Vice President, chose for the same term, be elected as follows." The election procedure is rather complicated, so before entering into details, let's see how the delegates in Philadelphia arrived at this conclusion that there should be a president for 4 years and a vice president. As I told you before, the opposite factions in Philadelphia were those who wanted a very strong national government and those who wanted a weak government and strong states. Of course, the last ones didn't want a president with a lot of powers, and they were more in favor of an executive council. There were various proposals on the tables. A council composed by 3, 5, 7, 11 persons, and all of them should have been chosen basically by the legislature. there were also mixed formulas, for example, a president assisted by the judges of the Supreme Court, or other hypotheses of this kind. This approach was rejected rather early by the convention, and the convention voted for a single person as executive. There was a proposal to name him governor, but in the end the title chosen was president. The reason for this choice was that a single person guarantees more rapid decisions, more energy in executing the tasks he has. The Continental Congress had no single executive body, and it had only committees, and the experience with troubles in finding agreement within the committees made the delegates to prefer a single person as executive. So they chose a president, but there was a very long debate on how long it should remain in charge. The length of the term of the president was a topic much discussed in Philadelphia, because there were different ideas. For example, the extreme faction of the nationalists, represented by Alexander Hamilton of New York. Hamilton proposed a plan in which the president would have been elected for life. The formula, as for the justice of the Supreme Court, was during good behavior. That means unless someone is ill or mad or a traitor, during good behavior the justices of the Supreme Court remain in their job, and the idea of Hamilton was to have a president of the same kind. This idea, however, was deeply unpopular among the other delegates, because it smacked of a kind of a Republican king, someone who cannot be ousted, even if his performance is weak, unsatisfactory, or even tyrannical. So the problem was how long should be the president term, and there were different ideas on this topic as well. For example, one idea was 7 years and no re-election. The other idea was 4 years with the right to be re-elected. Some delegates thought that the incentive of having the opportunity of remaining in charge after the first term was an incitation, an incentive to be efficient and honest. So the premium, so to speak, for a good president would be re-election. And in the Constitution, there were no limits to the number of times one president can be re-elected. Historically, all presidents had one or two terms. For example, the first one, George Washington, who could have been easily re-elected many times, chose to retire after two terms, and the same did Thomas Jefferson and other 19th century presidents. The only president in the entire history of the United States who has been elected more than twice was Franklin Roosevelt, who was elected for the first time in 1932 and was elected again in 1936, in 1940 and 1944. He died in office in 1945. As a result of this domination by a single man elected four times, the Republican majorities in the Senate and in the House in the early 50s voted a constitutional amendment that prohibits more than two terms for any president. So since 1951, when the amendment was ratified, American presidents can serve only two terms of 4 years. The length of the term was only one of the issues in Philadelphia. The other issue was how to elect the president. And on this topic there were two opposite sides as well. Because one idea was to have the president elected by Congress, of course. There were several different proposals elected by jointly by the House and the Senate, elected only by the Senate, elected only by the House. And at some point of the convention, indeed, there was a vote for a president elected by the legislature. This happened in July. However, the delegates in Philadelphia have all read their Montesquieu, and they were absolutely certain that the fabric of the government should be based on the separation of power. And the president elected by the parliament would be dependent from the power. Note that this has always been the British solution, that is, the leader of the majority is the prime minister, and in the entire Europe during the 19th century at different times, this was the solution preferred. But this was not the idea of delegates in Philadelphia, because they wanted to separate the executive from the legislature. In some way, their idea was that there was a need for a check, a control, a supervision of Congress itself. They were afraid not only of the tyranny of the executive, but also of the tyranny of Congress. And In this debate, they decided that the president should be elected not by Congress but by someone else. This someone else, however, proved to be far too difficult as a problem, and idea advanced by some delegates to have a president elected by the people was voted down rather quickly. The delegates in Philadelphia were certainly able politicians, but they were not the great democratic, most of them. Some of them had indeed very democratic ideas, but they were a tiny minority. So the idea of having the people elected electing the president was refused. And if there was no legislature, no people at large, another possible solution would be to have it to have him elected by the states, but also this seemed a cumbersome solution, and moreover it was exactly the opposite of what the nationalist faction wanted, that is a strong independent executive. The stalemate went on through the end of August, and it was only in the very last days of the convention that someone found a solution, and it was of course a complex compromise. The results was like this. Each state shall appoint in such manner as the legislature may direct a number of electors equal to the whole number of senators and representatives to which the state may be entitled in Congress, but no senator or representative or person holding an office of trust or profit under the United States shall be appointed an elector. So, as you can understand, the word electors here doesn't mean the citizens at large. It has the meaning of a small body of people to whom is given the task of electing the president. And these electors are in number, state by state, equal to the number of senators and the representatives. Of course, as the senators are always two, that means that this system over-represent the small states. For example, under this system, Delaware has three electors and Virginia have 12. But the population of Virginia is not four times the population of Delaware, is about 10 times. So this method over-represent the small states. I see perplexity there. You should bear in mind that even if there were great differences in the size of population of the different colonies at that time, these differences were rather minor compared to today. At that time, probably the ratio between the largest state, Virginia, and the smallest one was 9 to 1 as number of citizens. today you have several states that have a population of less than 1 million, Wyoming, North Dakota, South Dakota, Alaska, are all states with a population between 600,000 and 700,000 people. And all these states, of course, keep their two senators, while California, that has about 35 million people, has equally two senators. So now, of course, the part of representatives in the California delegation is big. California has 54 representatives in the House. So for the presidential election, California has 54 plus 2, 56. And Alaska, Wyoming, North Dakota, South Dakota has 3. But again, this system overrepresents the small states. The compromise, the key part of the compromise was the fact that presidential election should be a state affair. So the decision, the key decision for the executive was the fact that each state shall appoint in such manner as the legislature thereof may direct a number of electors. This, of course, gave all the power to the states, and the states could if they wanted appoint as electors the governor or they could even choose the electors by ballot if they wanted. Any way of choosing the electors is constitutionally permitted because this article precisely says each state shall appoint in such manner as the legislature may direct. So it's not a national election, is a state by state election. And this is the reason why now the so-called Electoral College, the body of the electors from the 50 states, is such an issue. When I say electoral college, you should bear in mind that there is no meeting of the electoral college per se. The delegates meet only once. In December in each state for the purpose of voting for the president. So when you watch CNN the night of the election, you see that the anchorman says California is for the Democratic candidate, and Wyoming is for the Republican candidate, New York so-and-so, and Ohio so-and-so. And this is because the election is a state affair, and being a state affair, it's not certain then a majority at the national level convert into a majority in the Electoral College. Why? Because today all states choose the electors through popular election. So the first Monday after the first the first Tuesday after the first Monday in November, about 100 million Americans, recently 120 million, go to the polls and they vote for the president in theory. This is the representation the media give us of the election. Florida votes for Obama, and Mississippi vote for McCain. But this is not exactly the reality. The reality is that the citizens in Florida vote for a list of Democratic electors, and the citizens in Mississippi vote for a list of Republican electors. Those two lists will compose the state body that in December will vote for the Republican candidate or the Democratic one. Now there is another passage. How do you translate the citizens' votes in delegates, in electors? You could do in several ways. For example, if you have in the state of New York, let's say Ohio, which is a better example. If you have in the state of Ohio 51% of the votes for the Republican candidate and 49% for the Democratic candidate, it would be quite logical to split the number of electors in half. Or you may give a prize to the majority and split the 21 electors, for example, 11 for the candidate with more popular votes and 10 for the candidate with less popular votes. This would be called a proportional representation. In the US, proportional representation was never a popular system. For reasons linked to their British experience, the United States always adopted a system which is known as first past the post, also winner take all. Both these expressions means this: if there are 10 candidates and I have one vote more of the second, and the second has two votes more of the third, and so forth, even if I take, let's say, 15% of the global vote, I'll be elected. No runoff between the first two candidates, for example. In Europe, usually, let's think to an example that you should know. How do you elect a mayor in Italy? There are several candidates, but if no candidate has more than 50% of the vote, the two candidates with, say, 40% and 30% will go into a runoff, that is, you should vote again 2 weeks later for mayor. This doesn't happen in the US. If you have 30% of the vote but the other candidates have less than that, you are automatically elected. So this is the reason why many American presidents have been elected with less than 50% of the vote. For example, in recent times, Bill Clinton got only 43% of the vote. I'm not sure about... Yes, but that's quite possible. But even Abraham Lincoln had about 40% of the vote in 1860. And he was elected because the system is called the winner of the race, so to speak, the winner take all. So what has this to do with the election of the president? Very much, because the lists of electors, the group of delegates state by state, are allocated to the winner of the race in that state. So, for example, in Minnesota last year, there was a race for a seat in the Senate, and after the vote, the votes were counted and recounted and recounted again, the Democratic candidate had about 100 votes more than the Republican candidates, but this was in about 4 million votes cast by Minnesota's citizens. So in the two candidates was in a competition in which they had 2 million votes each, and one of them had only 100 ballots more. This candidate won the seat for the Senate, but if the race would have been for president, the party with 100 votes out of 4 million would have been all the delegates of the Minnesota delegation. The Minnesota presidential election would have been allocated to the party with 100 votes more among 4 million, 3 million. In Florida in the year 2000, there were only 500 votes difference between George Bush and Al Gore in 5 million votes. And the 25 presidential electors of Florida went to the Republican Party and they voted for George Bush. The case of the elections in 2000 is interesting because it is evidence of how you can have a majority of the popular vote, that is, at national heaven, at national level, you can have the votes of a majority of American citizens, but making the sum of state by state delegates, this could not be, it's rare, but it happens, could not be a majority in the Electoral College. And in fact, the number of presidential electors is now fixed at 538. Why 538? Because there are 435 representatives. That is, the House has 435 seats. The Senate has 100 senators, and that makes 535. And as I told you yesterday, there are three presidential electors for the District of Columbia, which is not a state, and so the global sum is 538. Of this, the majority is, of course, 270. In the year 2000, George W. Bush had 271 votes in the Electoral College, and Al Gore had 267, but Al Gore had more than 500,000 votes more than George Bush. So this was an accident, so to speak, but it was not the first time, because in the 19th century it happened three times that a president elected by the Electoral College did not have a majority of the popular votes. So that makes clear that the Electoral College mechanism to elect the president is at fault. It's a system who was designed for a different country. It was designed as a compromise between opposite factions, and it was put together clearly not to last 200 years, but to solve the immediate problem of having a successful convention. 200 years later, the problem has become very big indeed. So all this is quite complicated, so before going on, I would take some questions about numbers.
What I didn't understand quite well. In each state, the population votes for a list of,
yes,
of the party or the two parties. Then the list that chooses then decides to choose the candidate also. If they are Republican, let's say they choose a Republican.
Of course.
But if there are two Republicans which race for the presidency, then the college will choose.
No, there cannot be two Republicans. There can be one Republican and one independent candidate. The parties have their own primaries. The primary election, we shall see what they are in a minute. But each party has one candidate, then you can have several independent candidates. We think to the American political system as a two-party system, but this is a simplification. Nobody forbid an independent candidate to present himself if he has sufficient support. For example, the consumer advocate Ralph Nader was a candidate several times. The Texan businessman Ross Perot was a candidate twice. The Republican Party has a list of electors. If they are elected by a majority of the popular vote, they will vote for the presidential candidate of the Republican Party.
And I didn't understand by which kind of vote the list is elected.
By which kind?
Of vote the list is elected.
By the popular vote.
Yes, but by which kind? Not proportional representation, but by which kind?
First past the post. That is... Yes. If in New York you have 2 million for one candidate and 2 million and 10 votes for the other candidate, the group of delegates, the list will be for the second one, the entire group. Yes.
This is the case of a direct election.
Indirect. Yes, it's a second degree election, so to speak. We think to the president of the United States as someone elected at large by the people, but it is not so.
I didn't understand how many electors are there for each state?
Well, it depends.
Equal to the number of, you said, I didn't understand.
No, the total number must be equal to the number of representatives plus senators plus 3 for the District of Columbia. Bear in mind that we are not talking about the actual representatives or the actual senators. We are talking about different persons, but the number must be this. And they are allocated state by state according to the population. Because in the House, for example, California has 54 seats and North Dakota only one. So in California there will be 54 plus 2, 56 presidential electors, and in North Dakota there will be 1 plus 2, 3 presidential electors.
Does it happen occasionally that those electors vote, not as they supposed to vote, not in the line of...
Yes, this is a very interesting question, because it happened very rarely. Usually the parties choose people who are rock solid in their political faith. But sometimes it happened, never with political consequences. But for example, in 76, the Republican candidate was Gerald Ford, the president who came after Richard Nixon's resignation. And in 76, there was a strong wing of the party who supported Ronald Reagan, and some electors who should have voted for Gerald Ford, who was the official candidate, refused to do so and voted for Ronald Reagan nevertheless. So Gerald Ford in the end had a few less votes compared to what he should have been. But this never provoked political problems. For example, if in 2000 just two faithless electors, they are so called, the electors who don't vote for the candidate they are supposed to vote, in technical terms are called faithless electors. If just two of them would have changed the camp and vote for Al Gore, the Electoral College would have split precisely in half, 269 and 269. And in this case, the election would have been decided by the House of Representatives. As it happened, for example, in 1824. But this is another matter, and we shall look at it in a minute.
Why Maine and Nebraska don't adopt the system of the winner take all?
Well, that's another good question, because they are smarter than the others, probably. Maine and Nebraska don't have complete proportional representation, but they split the delegates more or less according to the strength of the two parties. For example, there was an interesting case last year. Nebraska was the first case in a million years of a state where the electoral vote is split, because Nebraska is a heavily Republican state which has five presidential electors. And so the Republicans had four presidential electors, but Obama won one, because in the city of Omaha, which is predominantly Democratic, it makes a congressional district, and so Obama was able to gather one presidential vote from Nebraska, where no Democratic candidate had any vote for decades. If all the states would make the same choice, that would be a revolution in the political equilibrium and also in the way the campaigns are conducted, because now you probably know that the two parties concentrate their efforts in some key states, the so-called swing states. There is no real campaign in New York, which is Democratic, or in Alabama, which is Republican. So, but the constitutional problem is that all states should agree to a different method of choosing the electors, because this is a matter in which the Congress cannot make laws. If Congress would make a law, suppose the presidential electors are elected by proportional representation at the state level, the Supreme Court most certainly would consider the law unconstitutional, because the Constitution is quite clear: election is a matter for the states. The only way to do that would be through a constitutional amendment.
As I can remember, one reason to establish this electoral college was the fear of the delegates, that they thought that the popular vote the people could vote for a president who's not good for the country and something like that. Is that right?
Well, at that time there was the idea that the people in Massachusetts couldn't know any candidate from Virginia and vice versa. So the presidential electors should have been a body of men of vast political experience and dedicated to public service, and in this body they should make their choices. But they thought that the possibility of no candidate gathering enough votes in the Electoral College was present in the mind of the convention in Philadelphia. And in fact, they created a reserve mechanism, so to speak, if nobody has a majority in the Electoral College. Now I turn to this topic. The person having the greatest number of votes for president shall be the president, if such number be a majority of the whole number of electors appointed. And if no person have such majority, this is the reserve mechanism. I'm reading not from Article 2, but from Amendment 12, because this section was changed by the 12th Amendment. If such number be a majority of the whole number of electors appointed, and if no person have such majority, then from the persons having the highest numbers not exceeding 3 on the list of those voted as president, the House of Representatives shall choose immediately by ballot the president. But in choosing the president, the votes shall be taken by states, the representation from each state having 1 vote. So what does that mean? For example, in 1824, there were not 2 major candidates, but 4. And the votes in the Electoral College split among these candidates. The candidate who had the more popular votes was General Andrew Jackson. Then the son of the second president, John Quincy Adams, then the Speaker of the House, Clay, and there was also a 4th candidate. When they had to register, then there was no majority in the Electoral College, the House voted. So the actual representatives, no, not the presidential elector, the representatives caucused, this is the term, made a caucus of each delegation, and each state delegation decided how to vote, and the majority of the state delegation in the House were for John Quincy Adams, who was elected president. But in Philadelphia, the delegates thought that this could be quite a normal option, quite a regular possibility, because at that time, at time of the Constitutional Convention, there was no idea of a two-party system. Actually, the Founding Fathers mistrusted political parties very much. They called them factions, and they thought they were a curse for the Republic. But they thought that it could indeed happen that 3 or 4 candidates have the votes of their home states, of their region, and the House should choose the president. The Congress may determine the time. I'm back to Article 2, Section 1. The Congress may determine the time of choosing the electors and the day on which they shall give their votes, which day shall be the same throughout the United States. Now, this day is in mid-December. It's like the first Wednesday after the second Tuesday, but I have no precise recollection. It's around December 15. No person except a natural-born citizen or a citizen of the United States at the time of the adoption of this Constitution shall be eligible for the office of president. Neither shall any person be eligible to that office who shall not have attained to the age of 35 years and been 14 years a resident within the United States. This is interesting because no other public office in the US has this clause, that is, you can be born in Kazakhstan and become a representative, a senator, or even a Supreme Court justice, if you have emigrated to the United States. But this is not possible now for the office of president. And there have been two interesting cases of people who could have been candidates for president. First, Henry Kissinger, the Secretary of State of Richard Nixon, who was born in Germany. And more recently, this tells something about the state of politics. Schwarzenegger, the former actor and now governor of California, he was born in Austria, and so he couldn't present his candidacy for president. And there was some talk at one point of a constitutional amendment to remove this obstacle and allow Schwarzenegger to be the Republican candidate. Nothing came out of that. But there is another interesting detail. That is that before the election and even now, a number of Republican officials, that is senators, representatives, and local officials, made the accusation that Barack Obama would not be a citizen because he would not be in Hawaii, as his birth certificate says, but somewhere probably in Kenya. And if you browse through the Republican blogs or other websites of the extreme right, the far right in the US, this idea that Obama was not fit to be president because he could not be elected because of this lack of citizenship at birth is still present. The president shall, at stated times, receive for his services a compensation which shall neither be increased nor diminished during the period for which he shall have been elected, and he shall not receive within that period any other emolument from the United States or any of them. As I told you before, the scale of government pay in the federal government is adjusted to the salary of the president, which has been for quite a number of years now $200,000 before taxes. That is much less of what an Italian deputy would take home, and the justices of the Supreme Court have salaries between 120,000 and 150,000. Representatives and senators are around $100,000 per year before taxes. Section 2, Article 2, Section 2, the President shall be Commander-in-Chief of the Army and the Navy of the United States and of the Militia of the several states when called into the actual service of the United States. As we saw yesterday, it is Congress that should call the militia. It's not the power for the President himself. He may require the opinion in writing of the principal officer in each of the executive departments upon any subject relating to the duties of their respective offices, and he shall have power to grant reprieves and pardons for offenses against the United States, except in cases of impeachment. Here there are several interesting topics, but let's start from the bottom. he shall have power to grant reprieves and pardons for offenses against the United States, except in cases of impeachment. Of course, this power of pardon someone who has been convicted by the judicial system is something that is a royal prerogative. It always existed in monarchies, and it subsists in the powers of Republican presidents in most Europe political systems. However, the interesting point here is that the power mentioned in the Constitution is pardon for offenses against the United States. That should mean offenses of political nature. Custom in the last decades has been completely different. Most presidents have pardoned people who were politically affiliated with them or who were financial supporters, for example, for trivial matters. Since at least Roosevelt, presidents have pardoned, have used this power of pardon offenses for indeed trivial matters like tax evasion or other crimes and misdemeanors of this kind. So the power of pardoning people have been somehow debased by the custom of the last presidents. But let's go back to the beginning. The president shall be commander-in-chief of the army, of the navy of the United States, and of the militia of the several states. Well, as I told you before, this is the key point that explains the aggrandizement of the presidency. The president is now the most powerful institution in the American government, and his role has been growing and growing at each war in which the United States were engaged. For example, in the mid-19th century, President Polk declared war. Well, he didn't declare war because he couldn't, as we said yesterday, but he launched a military expedition against Mexico of his own authority as commander-in-chief of the army. President Lincoln organized the Army of the Union to suppress the secession of southern states largely by his own authority, and the Congress consent came only much later. And also President Woodrow Wilson and Franklin Roosevelt entered the two world wars by and large of their own mind. But this enlargement of the role of the presidency became institutionalized, it became permanent, after the end of the Second World War with the so-called Cold War. Because there was the idea that the confrontation with the Soviet Union created the possibility of the nuclear war with a sudden attack by missiles or bombing with nuclear weapons, and someone had to respond within minutes to an attack. So this condition of permanent alert, so to speak, this condition that lasted about 50 years, because not even with the fall of the Berlin Wall in 89, Cold War was completely finished, but this condition created a presidency that could and should respond to an attack within minutes with nuclear weapons. And in the Defense Department of the United States, there always have been plans for a first attack. That is, the military planners of the United States have always kept this option of being the first to strike to preempt an attack by an enemy. Even today, if you could have access to the discussions in the Pentagon, you would find people making a list of targets in Iran with the idea of preempting an Iranian attack, suppressing their missile sites and their bombing factories. So this role of the president became in two centuries completely different from what the delegates in Philadelphia had in mind. And the equilibrium, what is called checks and balances between the three branches of the government, between the legislature, the executive, and the judicial department, changed very much. The president shall have power by and with the advice and consent of the Senate to make treaties, provided two-thirds of the senators present concur. And he shall nominate and by and with the advice and consent of the Senate shall appoint ambassadors, other public ministers and consuls, judges of the Supreme Court, and all the other officers of the United States whose appointments are not herein otherwise provided for, and which shall be established by law. But Congress may by law vest the appointment of such inferior officers as they think proper in the President alone, in the courts of law, or in the heads of department. This point is interesting because it has no equivalent in most countries of the world. That is, the United States only recently have a permanent bureaucracy. The mechanism which is explained by this section of the Constitution is that the president, with the advice and consent of the Senate, should appoint a large number of officers who of course would be different from the ones appointed by his predecessors. This is what is called the spoils system. Why spoils? Because the victor, the winner in the election, has the quote right to have the spoils of the government, that is, to appoint officers he trusts. So this mechanism, of course, have some advantages, but also many disadvantages. In Europe, the prevalent opinion have always been that bureaucracy should be not politicized, and this is the reason why the directors of the labor department or the justice department in Italy or in Germany or in France, the high officers of each department and all the officers of inferior rank are permanent employees. They have what in American parlance is called tenure. So they cannot be fired at will. The American system was created when the federal government was much smaller. As I told you yesterday, for many decades, 90% of the federal employees were postal couriers, the people who delivered the letters. When the federal government grew and grew and became as big as it is today, this clause of the Constitution was limited, which is allowed by the Constitution, to the top echelon of the bureaucracy. So now you have probably 2 million civil employees in the federal government, and of these there are about 8,000 positions which are considered political position, and they need to go through the advice and consent of the Senate. Of course, the Senate concentrates its efforts on discussing the nominations of the top cabinet officers, of Supreme Court judges. If the president wants to appoint someone to a low-level position, most probably the Senate will vote in a few minutes. But nevertheless, this is a very cumbersome procedure, because even if you have not to fill the whole number of positions, because at the level of assistant secretary, for example, many people remain in office from one administration to another, you still have to fill around 2,000 positions. So there must be 2,000 nominations and 2,000 votes of the Senate to appoint these people to the top echelon of the bureaucracy. And of course you have not only people in the bureaucracy in Washington, but all the ambassadors and consuls should go through the same process. Politically, this was a point of great disagreement in Philadelphia, because the advice and consent of two-thirds of the senators for treaties and the advice and consent of the Senate for any appointment, all this was considered a system that created a dependency of the president toward the Senate. And the delegates in Philadelphia was not in favor of a president dependent from Congress. Also, as I told you before, the Senate was considered somehow a dangerous body, the nucleus of a future aristocracy, the defensor of the rich and the powerful, and for this reason this clause was very much discussed in Philadelphia. In fact, the Senate has shown to be reluctant to give its consent to treaties, at least since the 1970s. And for this reason, the presidents have had the recourse to devious means, like making agreements with foreign states or other forms of diplomatic action that are not mentioned in the Constitution and for this reason need not to go through the Senate. Section 3, he shall from time to time give to Congress information of the State of the Union and recommend to their consideration such measures as he shall judge necessary and expedient. He may, on extraordinary occasions, convene both houses or either of them, and in case of disagreement between them with respect to the time of adjournment, he may adjourn them to such time as he shall think proper. All this is to say that the president should be the executive department, but every decision should be taken in Congress. If you read closely this section, it says that the president from time to time shall give information to Congress. So it is implicit in this clause that the president informs and Congress decides. This is a plain, obvious reading this clause. Of course, the political evolution of the American political system has taken a completely different course. Now there is still the ritual of the State of the Union address, which is usually in February. And if you watch CNN, you can see the president reading his text in front of both chambers and the Supreme Court justices. And it's somehow a ceremonial occasion with many rounds of applause, but of course it has only a ritual value today. What has changed is the fact that now the real engine of the political process in the US is not Congress anymore, but is the president. So the president will not be limited to give Congress information, but he will produce most of the bills discussed in Congress, and he counts on his majority or negotiation with a different majority, if that is the case, to push his bills through Congress. This is something that reflects the different equilibrium between Congress and the president. And it started on a large scale with Franklin Roosevelt in 1933, because at the time the economic crisis was such that Congress has no idea of what to do, and the presidency became the center of elaboration, of planning, of action, and Congress had the occasion to show itself extremely compliant toward the president. I think in a few days there is the celebration, so to speak, of 70 years after the crack of Wall Street, that was in October 1929. But the economic crisis became more and more deep in the following years, and Roosevelt was elected only in 32 and inaugurated only in 33. So in the spring of 1933, he launched a series of urgent measures, closing the banks, for example, during the first 100 days. You may have read after any government starts, even in Europe, there is this term of 3 months and a half, 100 days. And it comes from the experience of the New Deal, when in this short span of time, the presidency pushed through Congress 15 major bills, and Congress approved all of them by large majorities. So if you had to rewrite the Constitution today, you could say that the president from time to time will give to the Congress information about what he is doing, because it is the president now the engine of the political process. Section 4, the president, vice president, and all civil officers of the United States shall be removed from office on impeachment for and conviction of treason, bribery, and other high crimes and misdemeanors. We already talked about impeachment, but this clause is interesting for two reasons. One is that impeachment is a very cumbersome process. It's a political process that could last for months, and of course the House and the Senate have many other matters in their hands. So impeachment is extremely rare. As I told you, no president has ever been impeached. Only Richard Nixon resigned before facing the trial. And there were several impeachments of justices, not of the Supreme Court, but inferior level justices. But they had practically to have killed someone to be impeached, because the process is not an administrative process, but a political one. If you have an incompetent judge or a corrupt judge in Italy, you can remove it by an administrative process. In the US, it's a political process, and it's much more difficult. And it is much more difficult because it takes a two-thirds majority in the Senate. The other interesting thing is that impeachment is a quasi-criminal procedure. That is, it is political, but at the same time, it's a judicial procedure, because the Constitution lists the reasons for which one president or other officer can be impeached. And these reasons are only three: treason, bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors. Treason is something that exists everywhere, and it is plain obvious. Bribery, it's not so clear, because bribery, one should define what size, what kind of bribery. The delegates in Philadelphia were thinking to someone corrupt by foreign powers, for example. So a corruption which is tantamount to treason in itself. But today you could think of bribery for trivial matters some money from a supporter during the electoral campaign, not registered in the proper way. So this is rather vague. The other point, high crimes and misdemeanors, you should note that if you look at the Webster dictionary today, misdemeanor is something which is not a felony, that is a much less important offense. If you go through a red light with your car, that is a misdemeanor. If you don't pay your taxes in time in the US, this is a felony. So misdemeanors are considered less offenses, but this formula, high crimes and misdemeanors, means in reality high crimes and high misdemeanors, and it is an English legal formula that basically had the meaning of crimes against the state, so political crimes. For example, violating the prerogatives of the parliament, corrupting the members of the house, and so forth. It's the equivalent of political crimes, like what would called in Italy high treason. So this is for Article 2. As you may note, the article is much shorter than Article 1, and the powers of the president doesn't sound very much important reading the list. And this is not a chance. This what was the way the constituents wanted to be. They were very much concerned by the possibility of a president who could make himself king, or a tyrannical federal government, or someone who would suppress the Congress, which was thought to interpret and represent the voice of the people. So the presidency was a second degree power, so to speak, in the equilibrium in the fabric of the government created in Philadelphia. It grew and grew and now probably is too big to make it smaller. Of course, nobody can say what the future has for us, but most certainly the president is today the most powerful of the three branches of the government, and this was not what the delegates in Philadelphia had in mind.